consider, if you will, a patented strawberry. You can touch it, smell it, buy it, and eat it, but you can't own it because it contains the intellectual property that belongs to someone else. And so today this thought leads us to ask, should we be allowed to own the legal rights to a food?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Hello out there. You are tuned into the 937th edition of the Food Chain Radio Program, or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Fremantle who are tuned in as we stream along in the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio with engineer Aaron Shore on the boards. Aaron?
Yes.
Do you think we should be allowed to own the rights to food?
Absolutely.
Absolutely. There's a man that knows. Also, producer Kelly Bayer. Kelly, do you think somebody should be allowed to own the rights to a food?
I'm thinking of Monsanto here, so I say no.
Oh, okay. The M word pops into the equation. Okay. Folks, please do consider a patented berry for a moment. You can touch that berry. You can smell it. You can buy it. You can eat it. But you can't own it, because it might be the intellectual property of somebody else. What kinds of intellectual property can there possibly be in a berry? Well, the intellectual property could be the berry's genetic makeup, its name, how it is described in the marketing materials, and perhaps the way in which it was packaged. Now, to really get our thinking fired up about intellectual property, let's turn our attention away from the berry for a moment and consider the Vegas Strip steak. Last year, the American Bar Association magazine reported the filing of a patent by Oklahoma State University on the method by which a cut of beef, a Vegas Strip steak, could be extracted from a carcass. This method was apparently unknown by millions of butchers throughout history until discovered in a lab by an OSU scientist. A little facetiousness there. Of course, somebody must have known about it. Well, having discovered this process for extracting the Vegas Strip steak from a carcass, OSU is now seeking a patent, which is a legal right to own the process. If the patent for the Vegas Strip steak is granted, anyone who wishes to extract the cut from any cow on earth would be required to obtain a license from OSU. Were your neighbor to butcher his cow and sell you a Vegas Strip steak without obtaining a license from OSU, the two of you would then become common thieves. This brief consideration of intellectual property leads us to ask, how does an item of food become the intellectual property of a private party? How does a private party maintain control of its intellectual property? And should a private party be allowed to own the rights to a public food? In the studio today to help us work out this question, we have Thomas Amrein, who is the Vice President of Nature Ripe Berries. Welcome back to the Food Chain, Thomas.
All right, thank you. All right.
Thomas, your father was one of my first guests, some 900 editions of the Food Chain ago, and your father was an attorney, and we were talking about property rights back then, and I guess we're talking about them today. Your family's interesting because your family, the Amreins, were farmers. They left the farm. Your father became an attorney. You went back to farming. How did that happen?
Well, I think it's because of the, you know, the roots of the family and always wanting to be outside and work out in the farm. And I think my dad's case, between the Dust Bowl and the Depression and World War II and a whole lot of things, you know, changed a lot of things for those people and disrupted their lives. So whether he would have been an attorney or not had all that happened is, who knows. So
now, I guess the Dust Bowl and the Great Depression changed a lot of people's lives when it got right down to it. Vice President Nature Ripe Strawberries, what is Nature Ripe?
Well, I'm actually Vice President of Nature Ripe Berry Growers, which is one of the oldest fruit marketing entities in probably in the country now. And it started back in 1917 here in California for marketing strawberries. And and then has since grown and become a worldwide berry producer, full-line berry producer and marketer, with partners in South America and Michigan Blueberry Co-op and the Munger Brothers over in the Central Valley. So we're a very large full-line deal. I'm just with Berry Growers, Inc., which is the strawberry and caneberry side of it, raspberries and blackberries.
Okay, good. Yeah. You also mentioned to me one time that you actually hold a patent on a berry.
Yeah, there's a raspberry. If somebody went and looked it up, they would see there would be this variety.
The Thomas Amrine raspberry.
Yeah.
Okay, good. Then you would certainly be appropriate here.
Actually, I'm not sure hold a patent is quite the right word. There's inventorship and patent and all that. So, yeah, there's
all kinds of
different legal things to wade through.
Also with us today, Cynthia Mathiesen, Global Intellectual Properties Manager for Driscoll's Berries. Welcome, Cynthia.
Good morning, Michael.
Yeah, you pull that microphone right up to you there. There you go. Good. So this is the first time on the Food Chain, so we're so happy to have you. How did you get into the berry business, Cynthia?
Well, I sort of was born into it. My dad was a farmer. I grew up picking blackberries and raspberries, apples, and he also had dry beans and grain. I grew up saying, when I grow up, I'm never going to do this. I hate this. I'm going to do something else. Well, never say never, because not only am I back in the berry business, but I am on the very ranch that my dad harvested grain on for now the president of Driscoll's father.
I once promised myself I'd never again wear a tie. And that was the end of my promising myself anything. So that's it, done with that. That's quite a title you have. But first of all, Driscoll's Berries. That's another strawberry company, another berry company, correct?
Right.
And tell us a little bit about Driscoll's, for those who do not know.
Driscoll's and Nature Ripe have a common background and then went separate ways. But very much like Nature Ripe, excuse me. And we are vertically integrated. We do all of our breeding, our marketing, our sales within Driscoll's. We, too, are also global. We're all over the world.
Mm-hmm. Good. Now, there is a significant difference, I think, I might be wrong, in the fact that Driscoll's carries its name with it to the supermarket. Does Nature Ripe as well?
Yeah.
They both do. Okay, good. So you both have something there that's really important, which is your name.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Okay. And that's certainly something to be important. You're also president of the Santa Cruz County, California Farm Bureau?
Santa Cruz County Farm Bureau.
Mm-hmm.
Paul would be upset if I said I was president of California Farm Bureau.
Yeah, Santa Cruz County Farm Bureau. Now, which leads me to think that there might be a lot more to being a farmer these days than just planting plants in the ground and watching them grow.
You know, that's one of the struggles we have, especially with our young people. And people in general who are not associated with farming, they think that it's just someone in jeans and a straw hat and out there planting berries and playing with dirt. And so much of, especially in the genetics part today, we have bachelor degrees, masters, PhDs. It's not just farming anymore. It's very comprehensive. There's a lot going on.
Well, before the show, I was mentioning a show we did way back when with a couple of strawberry breeders, Roy Springhurst and Hal Johnson. One bred strawberries for Driscoll's, the other bred strawberries for the University of California. And interesting to have them both in the same studio talking about breeding strawberries, because you really do realize that there's so much more than just putting seeds in the ground, because it's the management of the genetics of those seeds that really is important, because no single decision is more important than what you decide to put into the ground. It was interesting to watch these two gentlemen describe their long, I mean, they were very competitive people. They just like the Driscoll Berry and the University of California Berry, they're still very competitive. They are the berries, are they not, the two of them?
It's a lot more diverse than it used to be.
It is.
Yes, there's
who else is breeding berries?
Oh, there's any number of companies all over the world. And the acreage in California is much more diversely. There's much more genetic diversity in the strawberry fields of California than there was 25 years ago.
Okay.
And many more sources of material than there was. It's not dominated as much.
So it's not just owned by the two...
That's correct, yep.
It's two strains. Well, yep. Good. Folks, today we're going to be talking about intellectual property of food, or food as intellectual property. And with us today we have two people who are certainly in the know. Thomas Armrine, Vice President, Nature Right Berry Growers. Cynthia Matteson, Global Intellectual Properties Manager, Driscoll Strawberry. When you were growing up, did you ever think you would be a global intellectual property manager?
I had no idea what that even was.
Right back. You stay tuned.
Get this. You can earn a 5, 6, or 7-figure income by farming a small parcel of land in or near the city. You can be old or young, rich or poor, married or single. You can rent, lease, or own. You can farm small fruits on prairie bench lands, houseplants in coastal valleys, flowers on steep wooded hillsides, vegetables in city green belts, ornamentals in neighborhoods of million-dollar homes. There's only one catch. You must compete with other farmers for the consumer dollars. You can compete with others and win the consumer dollars with the help of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for profit in or near the city. MetroFarm is the Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner that will guide you step by step through the planning and development of your very own income-generating metropolitan farm. Abraham Lincoln said the greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living on a small parcel of land. Get in on the future today. Get a copy of MetroFarm at www.metrofarm.com.
We are back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, we're talking about food as intellectual property. With Thomas Armrine, Nature Right Berry Growers, Cynthia Matteson, Global Intellectual Properties Manager. I love that title, Driscoll Berries. Well, let's start off here. Cynthia, I see on your card here where you have Driscoll's Only the Finest Berries. And on Driscoll's, you have an R with a circle in it. What does that mean?
That's a registered trademark.
Mm-hmm.
What does that mean? It means that it's recognized by the government. You have a piece of paper that says you are legally entitled to use that, and only you can use that.
And Thomas, Nature Ripe has the same thing.
Similar mm-hmm. type of structure.
So this is our name. You can't use it in a commercial sense. Or can you use it anyway? Or is this?
No, it'd be infringement rights.
Okay, so this is our name. You can't use it. What if you were making Frisbees? Could you have a Driscoll's Frisbee?
Well, I suppose you could. I'm not sure you could sell it as such, because trademarks are a little bit interesting. Not only do you have the name, but you have the style and how it looks. So you have the word and the mark.
That's right. I remember when we went through this for our Metro Farm, you had to have a mark. You had to have what it looks like.
Right.
Right. So you could have a different kind of Driscoll's Frisbees than maybe. Except then you have to contend with Cynthia coming after you.
Well, as long as it's not a berry, we may not want anything to do with that.
You
know.
Do you ever run into somebody else using your name, Thomas?
I can't think of an instance where that's happened, but you have to be careful of it. Other than reuse of packaging, which is a huge issue, especially with food safety, where we have to be careful of that. Yeah, now where people might take a crate off the back of a store and then take it home to their little backyard patch and
fill it up
and then take it out and sell on the roadside, mm-hmm. and then that's an infringement, and that also has other areas of concern, such as food safety.
Sure.
Yeah.
Okay, and then under the Driscoll's, Cynthia, there's a saying, only the finest berries. And this does not have an R with a circle. It has just a TM.
That is a trademark.
Mm-hmm.
That is not registered. They're in the process of registering it. So until it's actually registered, you know, accepted by the government, you can't use the R with the circle.
Okay, now, if you were to catch Thomas over here saying that his nature ripe berries were only the finest berries,
he would receive a phone call from me. We'd have
Thomas,
a little chat.
You, okay. So that's a way of protecting how you want the world to see. It's your positioning statement. It's
right. That's our tagline. Mm-hmm.
It's how you want the world to see Driscoll berries.
Right.
Does Nature Ripe have one?
You know, that's on the marketing department side, because okay. I'm not specifically in charge of that. I would imagine I could think of some of the stuff that materials would have that.
But they probably have something like that they protect as well. Yeah. So these are all trademark. These are ways of protecting your intellectual property. Are there other ways? What about a plant patent like Thomas has for the raspberry?
Right. That's more what I do. The Driscoll's registered trademark and our tagline is just like Nature Ripe. It's marketing.
Mm-hmm.
So I actually protect our genetics, our berries, with patents, plant breeders' rights, plant variety rights, registrations. Every country calls it something different.
Ooh, that must be interesting then. So every country calls it something different. And you being, what was the title again? Global Intellectual Properties Manager. That means you have to run around the world and figure out everybody's way of doing things.
Not physically,
things.
But yeah, mm-hmm. That's true. That's true. It's different. It's frustrating sometimes. Some countries are more get it, and some don't.
Mm-hmm. And you go through the same thing with your
berries. Yeah, and again, you don't want to confuse things like inventorship with patent. Patent. I don't personally hold a patent, control a patent. There's inventorship and different things that go along with that within the patents. So
there's I guess you get a lawyer for that, right?
Oh,
or maybe a dozen?
There's all kinds of people involved, and you need to, again, and it's all got to be done right, because people have to understand that, I'm talking about the diversity of the strawberries in California, that exists because there's an incentive to breed and create new varieties. So that in and of itself creates diversity, and if you didn't have protection of what somebody couldn't protect what they've created, there would be no point in creating it. And so that really, it's not the strawberries as a food aren't controlled. The genetics, basic genetics, are all out in the public domain. Mm-hmm. It's those combination of genetics that somebody spends millions or even tens of millions of dollars over many years to develop, that combination, that's what's protected.
Well, the Plant Patent Act of 1974 established this legal framework for protecting the intellectual property of plant genetics. Before that, was there no innovation?
Probably more backyard. I mean,
I think of Norman Borlaug and his work with wheat and rice. Was it that before 1974?
Yeah. I think what you're referring to, that act cleaned things up because there's a lot of muddy water, but there was already, in other words, there was already, certainly there was, by then Driscoll already, you'd already had patented strawberries. And,
right,
and
I think both of our companies,
the University
of
California did, there was a royalty structure. That's been in place for many years, but there's, as things developed and technology developed, It became all that had to change. They had to clear some things up, and also had to clear up the difference between what is it that's protected. In other words, is it the fruit? Is it the seeds on the fruit? Is it the seeds separate from the fruit? Is it the little
pollen.
Green the pollen, the leaf? Because all that contains genetic material.
Oh, and it's every cell, right?
Right, exactly, and it's not all protected in the same way.
Oh, this is getting really confusing then.
Yeah, and what you can do with it and at what point as a non-patent holder you can do different things with different parts of a plant or all.
Wow.
It's very complex.
What exactly is in a berry that you would want to protect, Cynthia?
Well, my first answer would be genetics, but...
right, because, and what about genetics?
Well, you can go through and take a plant part and get a DNA sample. So we'd be able to say, oh, that is our berry, or that is not our berry, or just from the DNA sample.
Right. So that's probably one of the big reasons why they had a plant patent act in 1974, because, gee whiz, now you can identify through tissue cultures exactly what the genetics are. What in the genetics, what characteristics or what phenotypes, what are you looking for to protect? What do you do with a strawberry to make it worth protecting?
For us, it depends on who's doing the breeding and to what end. So in some cases it might be the it might be the disease resistant characteristics of that strain. So there are some breeding programs out there, let's say in strawberries, that have very good disease resistance characteristics, even though the characteristics of the fruit might not fit into, especially like Driscoll, which has a very wonderful continuity of flavor and color and characteristic through their whole fruit line through the whole year around the world. Okay, but you still might want to protect some of this material and have control of it because it has unique, let's say, disease resistant characteristics that could be brought into your existing program. That's
so
an example.
Really the product.
Yeah.
You're trying to protect. Well, hey, folks, this is the Food Chain Radio program. We're talking plants and food as intellectual property. You invite to participate if you so desire. Pick up your phone today, 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. Thomas Amrine, he, Vice President, Nature Ripe Berry Growers, and Cynthia Matteson, she, Global Intellectual Properties Manager, Driscoll Berries. 831-479-1080, 800-624-2665. Should people or private parties be allowed to own public foods? Right back. We are back. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. I am Michael Olson, and today we're talking food as intellectual property. During the break, we had a real interesting dialogue going between Kelly Beer, our producer, who's going, tell me about the T and the M and the R again. And Thomas Amrine and Cynthia Matteson came up with a pretty good explanation of the process and why we do this. Thomas, you want to start with your job?
Well, in the breeding program, you've got kind of two aspects of it, and I've always been more involved in the actual out in the field. I'm not a breeder, but was involved in starting a breeding program at Nature Ripe Berry Growers, and was fundamental.
Wait a minute, I'm not a breeder, but I was started the breeding.
Well, part of my responsibility
Just a minute though, isn't everybody out in the field who grows the plants an intrinsic part of a breeding program, because you see what's going on in the field, you see what the plants are doing, you see the reaction,
yep.
And you go back to the guys in the back office and say, this is what's going on, let's fix this or let's change
sure.
this.
And that maybe goes to the point, I'm not a plant breeder, but I was able to be part of putting together a plant breeding company and okay. being in at the ground floor of that, and I was more, I've been more engaged on that side of it, the production, what you'd call the production side,
sure.
food production, what's going on, you know, biologically, I guess you could say. And then there's a whole other level to that. So now you've got it. You've got, oh, this wonderful berry. We want to start propagating it. We want to put it in a box that says Nature Ripe on it, and we want to sell that berry. It's at that point that you have to have people like Cynthia,
Cynthia, your folks out in the field say, we've got it, Eureka, we found it. Now what do we do with it?
Exactly, that's where I come in. So there's a certain amount of data I have to go out in the field and take, along with photographs, to apply for an application. And the applications are different in every country.
And the application for a plant patent?
A plant patent is only in the United States, because, mm-hmm. you know, we Americans just have to be different.
Mm-hmm. So how is it different elsewhere? What do they do elsewhere?
Every other country that I've dealt with has an actual application form. Check this box, fill in this box. The United States, you just write a description and tell them whatever you want to tell them. Now, you do have examiners that will come back and say, well, I'm concerned about this, or I have a question about that. So there is some dialogue there.
Mm-hmm. So they've searched their records to see if anybody else has this same thing going, and then if there's a conflict, they raise the flags, and there you go. Right. So what if you want to protect what you've come up with in other countries? You know, let's take a couple of examples with countries with whom we seem to be doing a lot of business. One is Mexico, the other is China. Thomas, you would take Mexico?
Yeah, like in the case of Mexico, Mexico has a system of intellectual property protection to some extent, but you still have to be there and defend it and monitor things. And there's been varieties of, patented varieties that have escaped down there. Quote, escape. They've gotten
just
out.
I have a vision of a strawberry sprouting legs and running off into the woods.
Well, they kind of did. They kind of have. And exactly what happened was in one of the universities, it has a variety down there, and it got out to where everybody was propagating it, and everybody's repropagating it and planting roots, and pretty soon it's all over the country, and there's no control of the mother stock. And that's another important part. There's another aspect of this too. Part of this plant genetic protection is protecting the mother stock, protecting the root stock to maintain the integrity of that stock.
Because once it gets out there, who knows, you know, where it goes.
Right. It becomes mixed up and it loses its mm-hmm. its characteristics.
Maybe it gets crossed with a potato or something.
Well,
like
it wouldn't
that.
Happen that way, but it can become, if you lose traceability of the mother stock, there's all of the disease issues, because this all has to be cleaned up. It's got to go through a process to take the viruses out of it. I mean, there's more than just the paperwork and calling it something. There's a whole management process.
Right.
And you lose control of that. So like in Mexico, you're very careful. If you have a protected variety down there, you can be very careful about who actually has the rights to propagate, who is creating, who's reproducing it and delivering it to the growers.
So
and
when you take your stock down to Mexico, you got to kind of go with it.
You do go with it, and you control that propagation, because it all starts with propagation, and making sure it doesn't escape out of that. And if it does. An example, there was one here a couple of years ago at the University of Florida. They had a variety, it was in Egypt, I believe, that had escaped a little bit, started to escape, we'll say. And they were able to, they embargoed some fruit at going into the common market in Italy. They were able, the company that managed the protection of that variety for the University of Florida was able to identify that somebody had illegally propagated the plant, had picked it into a crate, and was bringing it into the European market. And using European market law, they were able to embargo that fruit and block its delivery. And that's what you have to do. You have to go out and be aggressive about that.
Okay, Cynthia, there are, you know, billions of hungry strawberry eaters in China. So Driscoll takes their plants over to China. And how do you go about protecting your genetics in China?
Well, that's real interesting. That's a new area for me. And right now the Chinese government only has a system in place to protect strawberries. And Driscoll's has raspberries, blackberries, and blueberries. We've approached them, put in a system for our other berries, and it's a communist government, and it's very different from a democracy where there's some give and take. In China, it's like, no, we're not ready. We will come to you when we're ready. So we're kind of stuck.
Can't you just bribe them? Yeah, never
well,
mind.
I suppose you could, but that's not something Driscoll does.
Good answer.
And to that point, see, what happens is then because, and there are people, there are other breeding programs that won't send stuff over there because they don't believe there's control. And so what happens is if you don't control, if you're unwilling to protect those rights, you're not going to get the benefit of those products.
Right.
So here's a company that could bring a huge improvement to the diet and conditions and economy of China if they could feel secure in having their product there, and they can't. Whereas in Mexico, there's been tremendous growth of the berry industry, and I think it's been really good for, particularly in central Mexico, with people like Driscoll or Nature Ripe and different companies. All different companies have all kinds of proprietary material down there, building a great program, and it's a huge benefit for the Mexican particularly the rural areas there where they need this kind of production and work. It's really been good for them. But if they weren't protecting if you couldn't protect your rights down there, you wouldn't be in Mexico either.
So it's one thing to get the rights. It's the next thing then is how do you protect them?
That's right. For me, intellectual properties is two parts. There's the protection, and then there's the enforcement. Protection is much easier to accomplish than enforcement.
It's easier to get the paper than it is to defend the paper.
Right.
Do you have any good stories for us about defending? We're going to take a quick break, and I'll squeeze one out of you when we get back. Folks, okay. This is the Food Chain Radio Program. Michael Olson, the whole notion that food can be intellectual property. We have Thomas Armrein, Vice President, Nature Right Berry Growers, Cynthia Mathiesen, Global Intellectual Properties Manager, Driscoll Berries. Wonder what it takes to fight for to protect your paper and your intellectual properties. Maybe Cynthia will come up with a story when we get back. Please do stay tuned. What do you think out there? Should private parties be able to own the rights to public food? That's the subject. Intellectual property. Food as intellectual property. We're talking with Cynthia Mathiesen, Driscoll Berries, Thomas Armrein, Nature Right. Cynthia, you promised us a story about protecting intellectual property, and so you're going to take us to Germany.
Yeah, that was an interesting process for me. Every time you apply for an application for a plant breeder's right, in particular in Europe, you have to go through the CPVO. They have very strict guidelines, and you have to send sample plants of the variety that you want to protect to what they call an examination center. Depending on what the commodity is and what the characteristics it needs, you know, a lot of chilling, not a lot of chilling, where it goes in Europe. There's about, I believe, 9 different examination centers. So I was sending raspberries for the first time to Germany. Normally, these examination centers in Europe deal with plants coming from Europe. But when we have to send plants from the U.S., we have more restrictions on importing into Europe. So they cannot have leaves on them. The soil, probably no soil or a certain type of soil. Those are just two things because they have to go through quarantine and all of this. By the time they arrived at the German plants examination center, I got a phone call from Dr. Schulte, and he said, "You sent me dead sticks." And I said, "Well, that is a cane that with no leaves. I understand it looks like a dead stick. Please, just plant it. Hold on to it, baby it for 2 weeks, and then call me back. I have been doing this business for 30 years. I know a dead stick when I see a dead stick. These are dead sticks." I said, "I understand that. Please, 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 just grow them for 2 weeks." Okay. 2 weeks later, he sent me an email, and he said, "I do see green leaves. I apologize, but it will cost you another year's examination fee." I said, "Fine."
It's always like that, you know. Yeah. Oh, boy, a chance to get more money. And, isn't that a big part of it? So you really have to, in thinking about this, you really have to protect your intellectual property not only from other growers who would like to pirate it and take it off and sell it, but you also have to protect it from governments, don't you?
I don't have a problem with most governments. It's when we go to China that I'm very nervous. For instance, in Germany or any place else, I am able to walk into an examination center. Obviously, you make arrangements beforehand. You just don't show up. And talk to the people who work there. Take a look at our plants. Now, there's plants probably there from Nature Ripe. I'm not allowed to look at those, and that's fine. I would expect the same courtesy going the other way. But in China, once you give those plants over to the government, that's it. You don't get to talk to them. You don't get to see them. Nothing. So I imagine behind closed doors, who knows what happens to those plants? So in that case, yes, I'm very concerned about government.
How do you protect genetics in China? What if you're Apple computer and you're protecting the genetics of your new iPhone? Is there any way of protecting anything in China?
You know, we've had a number of delegations coming to the U.S. from China on agriculture, talking with us, trying to figure out how we do things. It goes both ways. We ask them a lot of questions. We talk about just that subject. How do you protect things in China? And when wheat, or how do you protect them here? When we tell them, it's usually by licensing agreements. I mean, we own the rights, and then we license growers to grow our plants and spell out in these agreements exactly what you can and cannot do. Basically, they just laugh at us because that's just not going to happen in China. So it's going to be interesting when we go there.
Would you send your raspberries to China, Thomas?
No.
Nope.
At least we don't have the means to, and we're not a large, at least as large a company as Driscoll in that regard, you know, but just the administrative infrastructure that you have to have to manage something like that, we wouldn't even attempt it. I wouldn't want to attempt it. Now, we do have material around the world in other countries, but that's not one that we would tackle. And because you just can't, to your point, you can't protect it. And once it's out there, you destroy your own ability then. I mean, it hurts the whole industry. Mm-hmm. If we have a nice variety and it gets loose in a place like China, then it ruins Driscoll's opportunity to go over there and market their nice variety because there's already something floating around over there for free.
Yeah.
It was ill-gotten, right? And so, you know, everybody has to protect everybody in the game too. It's just not, you know, we had to think about the whole industry.
Can you protect your genetics in China? Do you think it's possible?
Maybe to a certain extent. Right now, I don't have a lot of confidence in that. I think, though, in decades to come, and I say decades because it's a huge country and you're going to have to change some mindset, I think it is possible to get them to change and see things maybe our way, the Western way, the rest of the world. Because as they start developing their own maybe genetics or iPods or anything, they're going to start seeing, oh, wait a minute, somebody else is taking this? We don't like that. Well, that's what you're doing to everybody else. So there has to be a consensus.
Do you think China would actually do that? I mean, it seems to me that China is so big that it wouldn't have to.
That's why I think it'll take decades.
Okay.
I think it's possible. It'll be interesting.
So, Well, we had a most interesting question at the top of the show from producer Kelly Bear, who, you know, when I asked her, should a private party be able to own a public food? And she said, I'm thinking about Monsanto, so the answer is no. So I'll throw that to the both of you. Given what Monsanto has done with its genetics and how it has achieved almost monopolistic control over its seeds, should a private party like that be allowed to own a public food? Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson, Thomas Armrine, Cynthia Mathiesen, a couple minutes left, but oh my goodness, there's all kinds of callers. We'll have to pick up a couple when we get back. Do stay tuned. Well, so the question on the table, should private parties be allowed to own public food, given the extent to which Monsanto has used this to monopolize control of commodities like corn, soybeans, canola, and whatnot? Thomas, what do you think?
Well, we want to make a distinction between what Monsanto does and what we're talking in the berry industry, because what Monsanto's doing is they're actually patenting a gene, and they're injecting these genes into different,
right,
you know, cross species, you know, it's a GMO thing. Ours is traditional pollinization, cross pollinization, and so what's patented here is an arrangement of genes that produces this variety. But the root genetic stock is in the public domain. Anybody can go out and get those. Just go out and collect your strawberry plants. You get a big enough collection, start crossbreeding, and you're going to eventually, as it took Nature Ripe or Driscoll 50, 60, 70 years to do, you work out long enough, you'll get something. So it's completely different than what Monsanto's doing.
Well, it would seem Monsanto's crossing species.
Yes.
You know, making dogs and cats.
Right, and they're claiming the patent on the individual genes, which is a whole different world from what we're doing.
You want to expand on that, Cynthia?
No, Thomas is right.
Oops. play a big game. Let's try going to Sally. Are you there, Sally? Hello, hello. Sally's not there. Well, there you go. At any rate, did that answer your question?
Yeah.
Miss Kelly Bear, it did. Okay, good. So the question comes to the table then, should we be able to own the rights to a public food? And I'm thinking about this Vegas steak, strip steak business. Oh, good. I have an engineer. Maybe he can help. What am I doing wrong, Mr. Richard?
I think we have to think about the difference between owning processes and owning genetics. Those are two different concepts altogether.
Okay, Ben, are you there?
This is the great Ben.
Oh, good. We have the great Ben. Well, fire away, Ben.
I desperately need a comment from you and your guests there because I'm in limbo on this one. There's a thing pending on the desk of the U.S. government called the Trans-Pacific Partnership, which is a secret agreement, much like NAFTA, and it's owned and managed by 30 American corporations who are going to do what they want. Here's my problem. They're primarily talking about raising the food to be fed to Americans here on American soil, subsidized by taxpayer dollars. But the food, the vegetables, the fruit, and the farm strip are all raised in pools of human feces. Huh. Now, are you talking about...
I'm out of time, Ben, but thank you for the call. Darn, I didn't know where to go with that one. Cynthia Mathiesen, Thomas Omrine, thanks for joining us. And thank you all for tuning in out there. And remember, cheap food isn't. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.